Hello, my name is Tom. And I'm bilingual, so I get to speak AA and Al-Anon tonight. And I'm glad to do that. And I had to get sober and be sober for a while before I ever found Al-Anon. So I live in Oakland, and I've been there since 1981, and I get over here on occasion. I'm not completely freaked out by bridges and tunnels, but I'm a little bit freaked out by bridges and tunnels. So I usually have to have a pretty good reason to go through a bridge or go over a bridge or through a tunnel. So I noticed there was this tunnel, you know, and I got through it. Welcome new people and congratulations on birthdays. The way I understand recovery is I get a daily reprieve from the worst of my crazy. In the recovering community, we don't talk about getting fixed, and we don't talk about getting saved. You can have a fist fight in the parking lot over are you recovered or recovering? And the answer to that is yes. You know, you really have recovered. Please don't stop now. There is ever so much to keep doing on a daily basis, but a daily reprieve. And let me see, what else do I know? Last Tuesday, I was asked to go over to San Francisco Bridge, go over to San Francisco to talk to the faculty and staff at St. Ignatius College Prep there, which is the Jesuit high school in San Francisco. And they have these month, I don't know how often, but throughout the year they have workshops for faculty and staff, and they want them to talk about spirituality and principles and, you know, motivating things. And they asked me to come and talk a bit about recovery to them. And a lot of the teachers are young people. I mean, it's a young person's job. If you have all that energy and zeal, you know, go hang out with kids. And I'm a broken down old high school teacher myself. And so I taught in Los Angeles. Anyway, so I was over there and I'm putting a talk together and I want to talk about the 12 steps and I want to give them a copy of the 12 steps because a lot of people, they've heard about them, but they've never seen them, you know, much less heard them talked about. So I wanted to do that. And I also wanted to do a few other things. And I came up with a list of books that are helpful, of course. And I mentioned the AA Big Book and I mentioned how Al-Anon works, my favorite piece of Al-Anon literature. And I mentioned William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience, and several other books, Gerald May's Simply Sane, Spirituality and Mental Health, and then half a dozen movies that talk about the disease and the recovery. And I'm putting all this together, and I mentioned it to a couple of friends of mine, and I'm talking AA and I'm talking Al-Anon. I'm talking AA and NA. And one of my friends said, are you going to mention Al-Anon? And I was stopped in my tracks because I wasn't. Now, the disconnect on that is I'm talking to a room full of high school teachers, and I wasn't going to mention Al-Anon. Because high school students act exactly like alcoholics. And I got the thing on detachment, and so I gave them a talk on recovery. But I mentioned one of the reasons I left teaching is I was burned out. A lot of us from alcoholic homes, we become helpers. You know, I'm not going to ask how many nurses or teachers are here tonight, but I know you're here, and social workers and members of law enforcement and members of the clergy and United States Marine Corps. I mean, we're all there. And so I presented, I told a few of my own things there, and I forget that not everyone thinks I'm funny. So sometimes they just stare at you, you know, with that, he could not have said that, you know, but I did. I mentioned that I taught high school kids drunk and I taught them sober, and it was a lot easier to teach them drunk. And a recovery group laughs, and a group of teachers and staff people gasp. That's one of the differences. So anyway, I'm glad to be here tonight, and I come as an adult child and the youngest in a family. It wasn't a nightmare alcoholic family. I know there are many of those. We were your basic San Jose Eisenhower Republican, two working parents alcoholic family. There were things that had been set in motion years and years before I ever came along. And my mother's side of the family had a lot of alcoholism. And it was all hidden by avoidance and euphemism and code. And we just don't talk about it, but people know what's going on, you know. On the Irish, my dad's side, the alcoholics were called characters. I have two cousins. One has driven the other to treatment over and over and over and over again, you know, but don't say alcoholic. My mom got a letter from one of her nieces in Sweden. My mom was born over there and came here during the Coolidge presidency. I mean, they listened to presidential election returns on the wireless. She talks about that, and they were all so excited they have a radio. But one of her nieces wrote her, and one of her nieces, who was in her 60s, one of her sons in his 40s, was put into the hospital for alcoholism over in southern Sweden, in Skåne, in the southern part. And anyway, this letter comes to my mother, and my mother mentioned it to me. I've been sober now 10, 20 years. And I told my mom, well, write her right back and tell her that two of your sons are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mother's response was, I couldn't do that. Shame. The shame stuff. You can't talk about these things. If you talk about these things, you'll die. You know? And it takes a while to realize when we talk about these things, we live. And learning how to talk about real stuff directly without a lot of editorial opinion. I think that's the first 10 years in Al-Anon, learning how to do that. Avoiding the hand grenades and the booby traps and the landmines, I mean, of any given family, walking on eggshells. I heard a fellow in Southern California, one of the slogans that he uses with his own people he sponsors is, don't take the bait. Which you understand or you don't. You know, because in some families and work situations and communities, you just throw the raw meat on the table. And then you watch, you know, the wildebeests and the lions and the vultures squabbling over it. And I have taken the bait a billion times because I thought arguing was very important and I had to hold my ground and I needed you to know what I thought about everything. And I have opinions on most things. And we had a family gathering and my oldest brother who... we don't have a lot in common. We don't see a lot of things the same way. We can talk about roses, so we do. But he has a lot of opinions, and all of which are stupid and wrong. Just so you know. Anyway, he and his wife, my sister-in-law, were somewhere, and they had an experience where they were well taken care of, although because they needed some medical stuff, and this country, I think it was the Netherlands, they got free medical care, just taken care of immediately. They didn't ask them to pay anything, and they were foreigners. Should I point out what they just said? And I said to myself, you don't have to say anything about this issue, because it was his birthday. You don't have to start a fight or an argument about healthcare in the world. And I want you to know it didn't feel good. I didn't feel smart. I didn't feel evolved. I felt like I wanted to throw up a little bit, because this was a chance to prove how right I was and how wrong they were. And you take the bait. And that's how arguments continue for centuries, you know, keep taking the bait. Someone else rephrased it a little differently. He said, don't pick up the grenade. And sometimes it's a grenade lying there, and I don't have to comment on everything. It took me years to understand that. Don't you need to know how and why I think like I do? So, you know, we gave chips and acknowledgments of birthdays, and I think that's a good thing. But someone told me one of the reasons we rarely celebrate birthdays in Al-Anon is because it's so hard for anyone to get 24 hours without fighting about something, you know, or taking control, or minding someone else's business, which is one of my favorite things. So anyway, family stuff. And so I'm a daily drinker. I grew up and I liked it. I played with alcohol when I was a kid, and it was fun. And you got to experiment with stuff, you know, and it was always around the house. And it was always when visitors came, we always served alcohol. And I remember I'm a kid, and one, 11, 10, one of the neighbors came over, and it was kind of a party, and they asked me to mix him a drink, and I'm 11. And so I, ice, glass, a glass full of scotch. Well, most people use soda or water, or, you know, they cut it a little bit. And why would you do that? And I remember him taking a sip of it, and he kind of, whoa, this is way too strong. And I have never said that about alcohol in my life. I live in the Jesuit community in Oakland. There's five of us who live there, and we all do different kinds of things. And I've been with this one fellow for since 1982. He's the easiest person to live with. And every day at around 5 o'clock, he has one double scotch. One double scotch. So I just find that amusing. And we have a joke. I mean, John, could I buy you a drink? I say, John, why don't you have a drink? And but what I just noticed this year, and I'm still surprised by this, he uses a shot glass to measure. Who does that? I mean, it's right up there, and so it, and you know, and boom, and boom, but boom, and he's done. I couldn't breathe when I saw that. I never used a shot glass. So there's alcoholic drinking and thinking, and then there's whatever those normal people look like, and I'm baffled by them. My middle brother is not alcoholic. When he was in Vietnam, he looked like one of us. But he came back and got a degree to teach children with special needs, you know, and held down a job and raised a family, no jail time, no suicide attempts. I mean, pretty boring. And I was drinking, and I remember saying, Paul, can I get you another drink? And he said, oh, no thanks, I'm starting to feel it. And you know, your blood runs backwards. You say, oh! And I said, Paul, the point is to feel it, you know? We get on the horse to ride. You know? So I'm amused by what those normal drinkers, and I'm around them. Another fellow in my house, his dad was a terrible drunk, but this another John. He works with hospice people, so he's a pretty remarkable human being. But he'll come home from a long day, and I've seen him do this, you know, a plate of food and maybe a half a glass of white wine, and he'll leave the half glass of white wine on the table and just go to bed, forgetting that it's even there. And I left it there. I wasn't going to clean it up. And he got up the next morning, and I said, John, look at this. Wine from last night, and it's still here. What's wrong with you? You know? You're never going to be an alcoholic if you leave half glasses of wine around the house. They're very different people, and I just stare at them. I'm a daily drinker. I liked it. I liked everything about it. I'm a daily drinker, and I'm a drunk driver. I heard my sponsor talk about that. He said he was a drunk driver, comma, pause. That means I was willing to kill you. And I grew up, we still had orchards in San Jose when I grew up there. And I remember, you know, cherry trees and apricot trees. And I know at least on one occasion, I drove drunk through one of those orchards. We were high school kids. We thought that was hilarious. Hilarious. No sign of alcoholism there. And I did not have to drink to drive dangerously, and I did not have to drink to take chances, and I did not have to drink to get involved in that world of adrenaline and excitement. But I drank a lot. Never killed anybody, never damaged anybody. But we'd drive from San Jose to Santa Cruz, Capitola Aptos, and drink. Because that's what 16 and 17, more 17 and 18-year-old boys did. We'd go to Capitola and drink. And one of our pals' mom was a drunk named Libby. And we'd drink with Libby. I loved Libby. We'd smoke and drink. We were 17. Libby gets sober. And I'm still drinking, and Libby's sober 5 or 10 years, and she runs into me. I'm about 28 years old. And she just looked at me, and she said, "You're still alive." I'm still alive, you know. But she wasn't sure I'd still be alive. I'm one of those obvious, loud alcoholics. So Libby got sober, and God bless her. But one of my mentors, one of the men who's tutored me, was a physician from Marin County, Dr. Gil A., Dr. Gil Iott. Gil's been dead now a couple of years, lived into his 90s. But Gil gets sober in the late Eisenhower years. And has dinner at lunch with Bill Wilson in San Francisco with a group of other sober people, I guess sometime in the 1960s. And Gil was thoughtful, and Gil was educated, and Gil was bilingual, English and French, and Gil paid attention. And Gil would talk about alcoholism and addiction to medical people a lot as someone in recovery. And he got macular degeneration and couldn't drive. And so we'd drive him around. And we who drove him around thought we were very lucky to be driving Gil around. And we wanted him to talk about anything because he knew a lot. And I went with him to one of these doctor things, and he talked about alcoholism. And he said alcoholism is a disease with three distinct phases. The first phase of alcoholism, it's the fun phase. It's when it's really fun. And you have such a good time. And I know some alcoholics tell me they never had much fun drinking, but I had a lot of fun when I was drinking. I looked really young. I my voice changed late. That was very awkward. What else? I was a sissy. I didn't play sports. I read books. I was one of those kids. And never threw a basketball in my life. And I still get baseball and football confused. So it's, they say, do you have a favorite team? And I tell them, I'm an agnostic. I don't care about any of them. Just don't matter to me at all. But I could drink. And I could drink guys three times my size under the table. And these were fellows who started shaving in the third grade, you know, and football players, and they'd have a couple of beers and pass out, and I was just getting my stride. I thought it was magnificent. Mature, masculine, strong, full of vitality, me, and drunk. And I loved that. It was really fun. And then that's phase one. Phase two alcoholism is called fun plus problems. It's still fun. But you start to have problems, you know, unfortunate encounters with family or police or strangers on the street, unfortunate unexpected urinations or vomitings or piercings or tattoos, you know, it's anything like that happens. You start to worry a little bit. The mood changes and the blackouts get in the way. And I was having blackouts in high school. So I'm 17, 18 years old and having blackouts. And I just thought it was the normal thing. And I didn't know that most normal drinkers don't black out. I didn't know that. So fun plus problems. Stage three, alcoholism is just called problems. You know, the good times are gone, but you're still doing it. You're still doing it. The first step asks the question, are you still having any fun? And if you are, recovery does not look good to you. I heard someone, Joan Larkin, who is an American poet, and she's written about a lot of things, but in one of her poems, she writes about not drinking, and she said, this is unspeakable deprivation. And that's what it was for me. I didn't not drink a lot, but there were times I didn't drink. And that's what I did. I didn't drink. And I woke up all day not drinking. And thought about it all day, not drinking. By this time, I'm in my late 20s, and I remember we'd watch Walter Cronkite, you know, and that's the way it is. And I'd look at my watch, and I had five more hours of not drinking, and that was not happy, joyous, and free. So to come into recovery, we need what we call the gift of desperation. I mean, a lot of people should be in recovery, but they're not desperate enough. They're still having a good time, or maybe they'll have a good time next week. You know, it's we delay it and stall it. When I share at an AA meeting, I usually mention that I'm a member of Al-Anon and that I joined Al-Anon when I was sober for a few years because I did not want to be a sober person who was shooting people. And, of course, the alcoholics wonder, well, who would you be shooting? And they don't know about Dark Al-Anon, you know, where that is the topic. And do you shoot to kill or do you shoot to maim, you know? And the room divides. You ride around. I was somewhere. It was an AA meeting, and this guy was, he was really angry, and he had weapons and stuff, and he was talking about weapons and stuff and guns, and the AAs just freaked out. You can't be talking about this! And someone said, go to Al-Anon, they'll understand exactly what you're talking about. The whole room will nod their heads and say, oh yeah, you sit right here by me, we can... we just don't shoot them today. You can always shoot them tomorrow, which is such words of hope. One of my friends, his thing is pushing his wife down the stairs. That's because accidents happen and gravity. You can just get sucked right downstairs and killed. And it just obsessed him for a while. And we explained to him that you can always push her down the stairs tomorrow. We just don't push anyone down the stairs today. And so on his desk, he has the word tomorrow. And they think he likes Annie, you know, with tomorrow, I'll find. No, but it saves lives. It saves lives. Oh. I have emotions now. One of the reasons I drank and used non-habit forming marijuana every day for 8 or 10 years was I don't particularly like feeling. I prefer numb. You know, numb and asleep is my idea of a vacation. And I'm not, so I go to my first AA meeting, was at 2910 Telegraph in Oakland, three central offices ago, two or three central offices ago. The new central office is on 7th and Washington, right across from the jail. It's a very nice, it's a great neighborhood to have an AA place. Anyway, I went to a meeting and knew nothing, and it was a Friday night meeting, and it was an old-timers meeting, and I was 29 when I got sober. I'm now 73, but I was 29 when I got sober. And these were, now don't hear this as judgmental, okay? But this was a well-lighted room full of smiley, happy, perky people. And that's hard to take, you know? Friendly and glad to see you. Ah! So I sat at the table and watched, you know, as they snickered and snackered and talked and were all having good weeks. And it was my turn to talk, and I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Tom, which is very aggressive. If you've been a little isolated for the last couple of months, to suddenly bump into Rotary Club friendliness, it's an assault. I had to make a few decisions about my drinking because... when I drank in public and when I'd get in trouble in public, there were witnesses, see? And you don't want witnesses. I was not drinking. And I was going to school, graduate theological union at the Jesuit school, Jesuits, Franciscan, Dominicans, we all had our own schools. And the Episcopalians invited us over for a social. And... at Church Divinity School of the Pacific, and I went, and I'm not drinking. Right, I've been dry now for 3 weeks, very dry. In Louisiana, they'd say as dry as a sore throat, but dry. And there I was, and I had no intention of drinking, and I'm standing next to this friend of mine who had seen me behave badly. And just a month earlier talked the Berkeley police out of arresting me for drunk and disorderly. If he had had a little more Al-Anon, he would have let them take me, but he, you know, I'll get him home, officers. And so we walked across the Berkeley campus, which was, it's a 15-minute walk. Well, I was very excited about a lot of things, and I thought I'd take all my clothes off and start warning people about the Nixon White House and the Franco regime in Spain. I was very concerned, and I was running all over. Now, some might say this is crazy behavior. However, it really was important at the time, and my friend just followed around with my clothes and got me home, and I woke up the next morning, on the north side of campus, knowing that the evening had gotten away from me. So I called my friend, and I said, what happened last night? And I've asked people that 100 times. What happened last night? Some would just say, Tom, what happened last night was you were a jerk, and you were a jerk for a long time. That's what happened last night. Well, that was frequently enough information for me. Let's not talk about that. So I was expecting that. What happened last night to my friend? And he had been to a little bit of Al-Anon, and so he asked one of those Al-Anon trick questions. What's the last thing you remember? Oh, I said, well, leaving Charlie's apartment. He said, well, we'll start with the police. And then he went down as if he were reading from a list, which he wrote down, which he had. Take notes. Be specific. Get a record. And the conclusion of that, having listened to this terror, I mean, I was sure I was losing my mind. I was sure I was becoming increasingly erratic. I remember at that time I was reading a book called I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. Highly recommended at the end of your drinking to read a book like that. And it's about a young woman who had multiple personalities. And that's how she survived. And she talks to a doctor, and as the young woman starts to heal, she starts feeling more without running away from it. And he says to the doctor, this really hurts. And the doctor says, I never promised you a rose garden. I promised you a life. You know? So anyway, there I am. So when my friend told me those things, the decision I made was I simply cannot drink with people who know me. And so I thought I'd drink alone a lot more because you have fewer fights. So there, back to the Episcopal school, and this nice Episcopalian seminarian walks by with a tray of sherry. Now, this is not my drink. Sherry glasses, toothpicks, fruit. I mean, sherry. I have no intention of having anything like that. And my friend turned to me and said, you can't have any of those. And I had no intention of having any of that until he said that, and then I had to have some of that because my whatever was challenged, and I remember reaching out for that drink and slamming it back. I have the vaguest recollection of horror on my friend's face. And I think I had 2 or 3 of them. You know, it's sherry. You drink it fast. And then I left the party, and I got a bottle of bourbon, and I went back to my room to finish the job. And then I entered this sneaky phase, you know, where publicly I'm not drinking, but don't tell anyone. So how do you hide your drinking when everyone thinks you're not drinking? Iced tea and vodka. That works. Until you fall over drunk, and then someone's going to notice. Scotch and milk, that worked for a while. It's not a bad drink if you need to drink. It's not a bad drink. And things like that. And what finally happened to get me out of this sneakiness and lying and covering up and fear, all that stuff, in the late 60s, early 70s, the National Council on Alcoholism did a lot of educating groups, and they talked to Catholic bishops and groups of superiors of religious communities, and they explained alcoholism, a disease, not a moral issue. They're not bad people. They're not weak people. They're sick people. If you have folks who are clearly alcoholic, get them some help. Don't watch them die. Don't make them promise to not drink again and then move them to another place, which happened a lot. My sponsor, who is a hopeless alcoholic of the worst kind, He was ordained a priest in the early 60s, and he's a falling down drunk. He never had a drink till he was 21, and then but when he drank, he was a falling down drunk, and he was fired from his first parish. He was there about a year, and the second parish fired him. You know, he showed up for the 8 o'clock mass at 10 in the morning. They threw him out, and so they shipped him off to a parish in Santa Barbara, and they had a reception for the new priest. And one of the ladies came up and said, "Oh, it's so nice to see a young priest. They usually only send us the alcoholics." So there he was. Anyway, he is a periodic. He had a horrific, sober a long time. Anyway, I was intervened on. We had a new boss, and I was his first alcoholic. And because I don't ask for help. You know, I mean, when I'm in trouble, I want to submerge and I want to sneak. Leave me alone. I'll sort this out. Thank you. And then vast amounts of delicious self-pity and isolation and self-loathing. It's just a lovely way to spend days and days and days. So I went into a 21-day program at Alta Bates Hospital, and I got a care unit. It was very AA friendly. I got out of it on a Friday and started my third year of studies on Monday, and I went to a zillion meetings. At that first AA meeting I went to with all those happy people in a well-lit room, we here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we go to lots of meetings. We don't drink in between meetings. And we don't use no dope. Well, those were three completely new ideas to me. I can't. Wow! So that became my program for a long time. I mean, you have to get a book and have a sponsor, and they talk steps galore. But I mean, basically, I didn't drink, I didn't use, and I went to meetings. I had a sponsee call me as we've legalized marijuana in the state of California. And he said, "Marijuana is legal now." And I said, "Beer has been legal since 1933. What's your point?" You know? This should not baffle you. You know, there are. I went back to teach, and I was sober a year. I finished my studies. My ordination was held up a year. I went back, and I took it kind of as a third step, you know, turning things over and show up and see where you end up. I try to keep it very simple and very basic. I moved to Los Angeles, where I met my sponsor, and we started hanging out together, and he also is the adult child of an alcoholic. And he was doing a weekend workshop, and this guy came up to him, and he said, gave his family name. "You're so-and-so of that family from, I think, Grass Valley," one of those places. And Terry said, "Yeah, that's my family." And the old man said, "I knew your grandfather. He was the oldest of six boys, and he was the only one that did not die of alcoholism. But that oldest boy had one son, my sponsor's father, who died of alcoholism when Terry was five." So, we have issues. we have stuff to work on. And there is so much more to being sober than being sober. I didn't love AA right away. However, you were interesting. People laughed, and a lot of young people were getting sober. In the mid-70s, I mean, my first day without a drink is when Gerald Ford was nominated for President of the United States. You can Google that and see that really happened, but it's August of 76. And a lot of young people were getting sober, so I didn't feel freakish. 10 years earlier, if you were in your 20s, they would have said, "You're not done yet. Come back when you're 40, if you're still alive," you know? So an awful lot of, and I moved on to Los Angeles, and I go back to the classroom. It's as if I had never taught one day in my life to walk into the classroom that first time sober. One of the reasons I drank was to cover up a lot of my insecurities and fears and shame and self-loathing, you know. And I taught history, and I was a I loved being with the kids, and I loved all of that stuff. But sober, I felt, well, I felt. And I think my first couple of years of sobriety, my usual crisis was, I'm feeling something, help me. And the feelings were black and red, you know, big. And I didn't know that people had a wide range of feelings, and they were strong, and they were quick, and they'd move so fast. And again, I thought I was losing my mind because I was having emotions. Those are two different things. And I was at a meeting, and I heard someone talk about being on the roller coaster. And I had an image, and I relaxed. There's two of us, and now I'm on the roller coaster. That's what's happening. I had a word for it. And I'm sober for a little bit, and I'm reacting to kids, and I'm reacting to kids. One of the life-saving Al-Anon slogans for me, one of the very first ones I grabbed onto, was act, don't react. Because I react. I'm a very intuitive person. I'm the youngest child in an alcoholic home. I react before I know I'm reacting, and a lot of it is just to survive. Act, don't react. Whew. And I would be reacting to kids, and I was getting angrier and angrier because they acted like kids. And they're stupid and they're selfish. And almost every year, there'd be an alcohol-related death. You know, a 17-year-old with a belly full of beer and a tree. So that was, I mean, I didn't know. And there was a kid, I remember, his name was Peter. He was this little guy. He weighed about 9 pounds. And 8 pounds of that was hair. It was just hair. And he was 15 when I taught him. He was really funny and cute, and he laughed at my joke, so I knew he was smart. But he started using something, October, November. By January, he was a different kid. Very withdrawn, very shut down. And I remember he came into class. And I remember grabbing him and shaking him, you know. And I said, you walk like a junkie, you talk like a junkie, you stink like a junkie. And I shoved him in the chair. And I had a moment of clarity. I'm like 35 now, 36. I kind of, in California, I had an out-of-the-body experience. You know, I went up kind of to the room. And I looked down and I saw a room full of 15-year-old kids who were startled and scared, and a 35-year-old adult male who was crazy. And the words at the bottom of the screen were, Tom, if you were 15 and in trouble, would you come and talk to you? So I had made myself much less useful as a teacher. And that's my first Al-Anon meeting. I went to a weekend retreat out in San Bernardino. And it was an AA Al-Anon weekend, although AA and Al-Anon don't do things like this, but members of the programs gathered. And they had an open meeting where both programs were discussed. And a man was talking, and his wife was the alcoholic. And he said to the group, in Al-Anon, I learn how to live with a crazy person and not go crazy. And I heard that. Part of the reason I heard it was from a man talking. And I don't want to surprise or shock anybody in the room, but sometimes some men do not hear women. I don't want to shock you with that. So I connected with an Al-Anon group in downtown Los Angeles, my first meeting, and it was mostly women. There were a couple of men who sat in the back, and they read all the stuff you read, you know, it just goes on forever. And then the woman who was secretary of the group had been secretary for several hundred years. And people would present their problems to her, and she would solve them. This is true. Now, in her behalf, this is a smart woman with a lot of resources, but she, you know, divide the child in half. You know, you could see that kind of thing happening. She was probably helpful, but it's not Al-Anon. We don't do that in Al-Anon. That's the crazy. When I'm the expert on your life and tell you how to run it. What that meeting was, rather than Al-Anon, it was a little visit into North Korea, you know, of this was a dictatorship. And I went to that meeting for a while, and then I found other meetings where we did follow traditions. And what happens in Al-Anon a lot is you share your experience, strength, and hope. And if you sponsor somebody in Al-Anon, you share your experience, strength, and hope. So I've tried sponsoring people married to alcoholics. I don't get it. I mean, I'm not sympathetic at all. Why would you marry an alcoholic? I tried sponsoring a couple people whose kids are out there, but I don't have kids. I mean, I've taught them and I've seen them in stories, but I don't have kids. And it's a very different thing. Adult children I can talk to because I know that particular crazy pretty well. So I was there a little bit in Al-Anon, then I moved back to the Bay Area in 1981, and I had to run for my life. I could not continue teaching because I was covered with all my reactions and craziness, and I couldn't breathe there anymore. I became useless. I was one of the angry, angry teachers. So I went from teaching in Southern California to doing social work in West Oakland for 3 years. Different crazy, but crazy. And I tried Al-Anon again, and then when I was about 10 years sober, it was time to do some work with good old mom and dad. And I started paying attention to things from long ago that were still influencing me a lot. And it's been a lifesaver for me. Here's a few things I've learned in Al-Anon. My experience. I went to Al-Anon a lot, and you don't always get it. You know, what are you people talking about? It's kind of very ethereal, and, you know, it's the vapors, and there's kind of a thing, and everyone knows but me, and and someone gave me a cassette tape of a woman named Blanche from West Texas, and Blanche was a teacher, and I still identify as a teacher. I mean, even though I haven't officially taught kids since 81, I still see myself as a broken down old high school teacher. Blanche spoke a lot in the late 80s and in the 90s. And there's a zillion recordings of Blanche. And we became friends. I had the chance to meet her, and we did become friends. She's been to my house. I've been to her house. But she said, in Al-Anon, we learn how to keep our sails out of other people's wind. And that was an image, like roller coaster. I got it. Because there's a lot of wind blowing. And I thought to be alive, I had to be in the middle of a tornado or a hurricane. And I don't. I needed the excitement. I needed the drama. And I guess after a few years in Al-Anon, I realized I don't want the drama and I don't want the trauma. Also, I realized a lot of things are none of my business. It's none of my business. And I have people who want to pull me into all kinds of things. And sometimes I say yes, and a lot of times I say no. Daily reprieve from the worst of my crazy. I was ordained in 1978, and I we're going to talk about a particular kind of crazy next. And I'm a teacher. A lot of us teach, but I also helped out in a parish in Los Angeles for the first summer I was ordained. And it was in Hollywood. And Hollywood in 1978 was a pretty rough place. And the prostitution and drugs and stuff happening all over, and a lot of homeless. And there was a hotel down the street that had, we some families stayed there that we were able to get in, but they also had a business, you know, reduced rates for in and out. And the way the parish worked is you're on 24 hours and off 24 hours and on, and it's kind of like emergency, if an emergency is there. And I was on, and the phone rang, and I grabbed it, and there was a young woman who had been knifed by a client down there at the hotel, and she wanted the priest. And I was dressed, and I was down there, I bet you, in 5 minutes. And the room had mirrors on the ceiling. I had never seen that before. And there were cops there, and there were ambulance people, and there was blood all over the place. She was still alive. I don't know whether they caught the guy or not. But the colors and the sounds were very loud. And I prayed for her, and I gave her, I think, a little bit of consolation. And then they put her in the ambulance, and I wanted to get in the ambulance, you know, and go to the hospital like in the movies. And the ambulance guy said, "This isn't Hollywood." And I said, "Yes, it is. This is Hollywood. This is..." But they don't do that because you just get in the way. But I vibrated with adrenaline for 3 days. And that's high. So I have to watch that. I have to watch that overstimulation, overexcitement. Because of the laws of physics. If something goes up, it's gonna come down. And I come into Al-Anon with a lot of rage and exhaustion. Those are still my issues, the rage and the exhaustion. I get angry at things. I have to watch what I spend my attention on because so many things are infuriating. And I have to focus, and I have to stay away from things that are none of my business, and I need to know what is my business. And that's almost different every day, but I that's a lot for me. I was in Southern California, and I mentioned at a meeting that I get angry. I mean, I have emotions today. This is a sign of life. I get afraid. I get angry. I get weary, I get anxious, I feel off center, I feel awkward, I feel flabbergasted. I mean, those are emotions. All kinds of different colors for those emotions. Anyway, I mentioned that I get angry, and this lady said, "If you were really spiritual, you'd never get angry." So each year of recovery gives you one more second of response time. That's the big deal. Between 10 years in Al-Anon and 20 years in Al-Anon is 10 more seconds. And that's frequently enough time to realize it's none of your business and you don't have to say anything. You don't have to, you know. So I waited a little bit and I said to her, "That's very helpful." Which is sarcasm, in case you're wondering. What a stupid thing to say to somebody, you know? But I didn't have to tell her it was a stupid thing. I just appreciated her help. So when I'm angry, and I don't always know I'm angry, because anger... Like depression can show up in a dozen different ways. Anger can show up in a lot of different ways. I don't think I'm angry. Sometimes I just think I'm right. You know, and you're in the way. You know, and you know, this will just take a moment and you won't feel any pain. You know. Also, I My family stuff, I was able to rebuild some bridges with my folks. And I had trouble with them. I mean, I think children and parents, there's always complication. And sometimes there's a lot more complication. But my folks, they got married in 1934. They ran off to Reno. They got married on a Friday, and they were both back at work on Monday because they both had jobs. So work was a real important thing, and good people worked and better people worked harder. And so whenever I've had trouble with feeling self-loathing or inadequate, or I would just work harder, you know. And I, for a while, I thought I was a workaholic, but I'm really not. Workaholics get things done. What I would do is just be extremely very busy. And part of it was, if I was always busy, my dad would notice and remember my name, which he never really did, you know. His children were John Paul Tom. He didn't know. So there was some stuff, and there was some rage, and there was some disappointment, and I was able to do some of that, some of the work of Al-Anon. Thank you very much. So when he died, I was able to preside at his funeral authentically, with respect. But that took some years. He was 92 or 3, and cancer diagnosis, prostate cancer, and he was down in San Jose. And I'd go and spend the nights. My brother lives in Redwood City and another near Fresno, and my mom. So I'd go and spend the nights, and if he needed anything, you know, nurse, you know, please come. So I'm very pro-nurse. And I would sometimes rub his hands and rub his feet, but he was never very chatty with us. But I was able to be there. And then he got a terminal diagnosis. You know, he's dying. And we knew he'd be gone very quickly, but he was still present. And my mom would come about 10 o'clock in the morning and spend the day with him, and then I'd drive back to Oakland. So I was there, it was about 10:30, and they brought in lunch. Or breakfast, I guess. Breakfast or lunch, hard to tell. And it was some kind of soupy thing and some kind of perhaps protein thing. And then they had ice cream. And he's sitting up in bed, and he reaches for the ice cream. And my mother says to him, soup first. I just want you to reflect for a second on how just those few words summarize 60 years of marriage for my parents. Soup first. And my response was, he's dying. Can't you let him have ice cream once first before he dies? But I've been an Al-Anon for a while now. And what, you know, the act, don't react part of the dance. What was very clear to me was this was none of my business. They worked this out years before I came along. You know, and I therefore used, but I was just full of emotion. I used an Al-Anon slogan to get out of the room, and the Al-Anon slogan was, I'll be right back. And I got up and I walked out in the hall, and if I had had a cigar, I would have eaten it. But I was so upset. But, you know, she doesn't need to know that. She's losing her partner of many years. And I don't need to make anything worse. You know, so it worked so much better. So thank you, Al-Anon, for helping me behave better. Here's a few other Al-Anon things that I know, and I may have said this before, but again, it's a lifesaver. A lot of things are none of my business. I have one of my nieces, for a while, loved dating basketball players right out of jail. There's a certain magic there. You know. And these were guys who were clean in NA, you know, but they had a little edge. And boy, there were opinions on that one. And I bumped into my niece, and I just said, you know, you're a smart girl. Take care of yourself. You know, this is none of my business. And I, you know, just it's your life. And if you've broken your mother's heart, I said, it's been broken so many times she doesn't even notice. Trust me. You just do what you do. And so we have a pretty good relationship today, my niece and I. We can talk about stuff. And other members of my family, we can talk about stuff. And I do still find family difficult. And every so often I think, oh, we're getting along so well. And then the next Christmas comes and it's civil war. A few years ago, I have family in Half Moon Bay in Redwood City. Christmas Eve, we were going to do a thing. And my mom, when she was alive and well, we'd do Christmas Eve at her house. And I remember being newly sober, like months. And I went down and I was pretty jumpy. I mean, I'm not drinking. And the family's coming in. And my mom asked me what was wrong. And I thought she wanted to know. No. They don't want to know. If one of your parents says they notice you're having some weirdness and they ask what's wrong, what they want to hear is, I've got gas, or didn't sleep well last night. That's what they want to hear. But I thought I heard it say at a meeting that if you told the truth, everybody gets well. Now, that's not true. That's not true. That's not true. So I said, well, I'm an alcoholic and I haven't had a drink since August and I'm pretty nervous about tonight. And she put the silverware down and looked at me and said, you'll ruin Christmas. Because I said the A word, you know. And, oh, man. So I have misread many situations and... Okay, I said, non-alcoholism, but I have a drinking problem. And she said, a lot of people in this family have drinking problems. Just don't call it alcoholism because you'll ruin your career. You know, the word gets out that you're a falling down drunk. And word was out that I was a falling down drunk. So Christmas Eve, a couple Christmases ago, I was just too freaked out to get over there. And it was all me. I mean, nothing... There was a bridge or two involved, but those were minor, really minor. I just got in my own way, and I overthought it, and I couldn't go. And I remember feeling embarrassment about this, that I should be so much better by now. But I've learned to take better care, and I behave a little better. Bit by bit by bit. We use the Serenity Prayer a lot. I like it a lot. And in the Serenity Prayer, it says, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And there are things I cannot change. And I was at a meeting in Texas, and I heard this. Here are three things I cannot change. I cannot change the past. I cannot change the truth, and I cannot change you. And that frees up the whole day. I mean, it really does. You know, the past, some stuff happened and there's consequences. Some stuff didn't happen and there's consequences. Oh, if only. I mean, that's a rough place to live. And the truth, you can't change the truth. I have a sponsee. We said, so what's truth? And I don't know if she knew she was quoting Pontius Pilate in John's Gospel, but I said, you know, the truth, the laws of physics, the speed of light, gravity, digestion, things that are true. Gravity doesn't care if you believe in it or not. It will suck you down. You know, you can't change the speed of light. Actions and consequences and Isaac Newton and Einstein. I mean, those are very important things to know. And every so often, I think because I'm so elevated as a spiritual being, the laws of physics don't apply to me. And I've had accidents in cars because of that. They won't let me turn left. I'm turning left anyway. Smack! And I've done that. I didn't do that drunk. That's a sober behavior. And I realize I triple the AARP senior driving course. And I'm a better driver. But I was acting as if I was above physics. You know, very dangerous. What can I change? Oh, and you know, I can't change you. This I heard in Al-Anon, and I wrote it down the first time I heard it because it shocked me. Loving someone does not change them. Changes me. And you can love some very uncomfortable, heartbreaking people. If you love an alcoholic or an addict, you will know grief, which is the other side of love. It's a big conversation. So what can I change? Three things. I can change my behavior. Sometimes that keeping my big fat mouth shut is a lifesaver. What I'd do when I got nervous is I'd get funny. And some of that funny was mean. But it was an old pattern. And so now when I'm in a social situation or a meeting and suddenly I think of something hilarious to say, what I've learned to realize is I'm uncomfortable about something. Something's going on. I don't even know what it is yet. Keep your big mouth shut. Change behavior. Change attitudes. Learn some new attitudes. It's not all about me. Get the chip off your shoulder. Can change behavior, attitudes, and change thinking. If I'm going to live in the world of recovery, I have to learn a lot of new things, new behaviors. The whole brain has to get rewired. And that takes time. I was at a group, Al-Anon Women, in upstate New York. And it's an honor to be there, and I was giving talks, and I was available for one-on-ones afterwards. And this lady said to me, if I knew you were an alcoholic, I wouldn't have come. And don't get defensive. Don't hit back. You know? I said, tell me about that. Well, her husband was an alcoholic, and he was a bad drunk, and he ruined her life and the lives of all her children. So I thought I was talking to someone with 9 minutes in Al-Anon. And then it says, so how old are your kids? She said, 28 and 29. Okay, so they're not babies. How long have you been in Al-Anon? She said, 9 years. Each year of recovery gives you one more second of response time. And I could have shouted, have you learned nothing in 9 years? You think your husband was a bad man. He was a sick man. But instead, I breathed a little more and said, if you need to go home because you don't feel safe, you can do that, but you're welcome to stay all weekend. And talk to some of the other women about their experiences. Get some new information. It'll change your life. I think my time's up, and I think that's everything I know. And I'm very glad to come here and hang out on occasion. And can I tell you one more thing? This is a brief moment for those of us who try to force the outcome. That's an Al-Anon phrase. My way or the highway. You're going to force the outcome. It's Lucy and Charlie Brown. And Lucy says to Charlie Brown, how many times does 5 go into 3? And Charlie Brown says, 5 doesn't go into 3. And Lucy says, it does if you push. So you want to watch your pushing, you know, and get into that place of some detachment and kindness. Take care of your own acre. You know, some self-care. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Life-saving. And so many things are none of my business. I asked my sponsor once when he was having a really good day. I said, how do you know what God's will is? And he said, it is God's will for each of us to have a life. Go get one. Which was very important as I was living an Al-Anon program. Thanks for coming tonight.